The persimmon velvet curtain rose, swiftly to reveal a space of uncertain dimensions in perspective.
At the lower left was a grotto, the cave of Mania, goddess of confusion.
Larches, alders, and Douglas fir were planted so thickly around the entrance that one could scarcely make it out.
In the dooryard, a hyena, chained to a pole, slunk back and forth.
Back and forth.
Continually measuring the length of its chain, emitting the well-known laughing sound all the while.
Except at intervals when what appeared to be fragments of speech would issue from its maw.
It was difficult to hear the words, let alone understand them, though now and then a phrase like,
up your ass,
or
turn the rascals out,
could be distinguished for a moment before subsiding into a confused chatter.
Close by the entrance to the grotto was a metal shoe scraper in the form of a hyena, and very like this particular one, whose fur was a grayish white, faintly tinged with pink, and scattered over with foul liver-colored spots.
On the other side of the dooryard, opposite the hyena's pole, was a graceful statue of Mercury on a low, gilded pedestal, facing out toward the audience with an expression of delighted surprise on his face.
The statue seemed to be made of lead or some other dull metal, painted in off-white, which had begun to flake in places, revealing the metal beneath,
which was of almost the same color.
As yet, there was no sign of the invisible proprietress of the grotto.
A little to the right, and about 8 feet above this scene, another seemed to hover in midair.
It suggested the interior of an English pub,
as it might be imitated in Paris.
Behind the bar,
opposite the spectators in the audience,
was a mural adapted from a Tenniel illustration for Through the Looking Glass.
The famous one, in which a fish in a footman's livery holds out a large envelope to a frog footman who has just emerged onto the front stoop of a small house, while in the background, partially concealed by the trunk of a tree, Alice lurks, an expression of amusement on her face.
Time and the fumes of a public house had darkened the colors almost to a rich mahogany glow.
And if one had not known the illustration, it would have been difficult to make out some of the details.
Seven actors and actresses,
representing seven nursery rhyme characters,
populated the scene.
Behind the bar, the bald barman,
Georgie Porgy,
stood motionless,
gazing out at the audience.
In front, and a little to his left, lounging on a tall stool, was little Jack Horner. In fact, quite a tall and roguish-looking young man wearing a trench coat and expensive blue jeans. He had placed his camera on the bar near him. He, too, faced out toward the audience.
In front of him, his back to the audience, little boy Blue partially knelt before him, apparently performing an act on him.
Boy Blue was entirely clothed in blue denim.
Of an ordinary kind.
To their left, Simple Simon and the Pie Man stood facing each other in profile.
The Pie Man's gaze was directed toward the male couple at the center of the bar.
At the same time, he continually offered and withdrew a pie coveted by Simon, whose attention was divided between the pie and the scene behind him, at which he kept glancing over his shoulder, immediately turning back toward the pie as the pieman withdrew it, Simon all the time pretending to fumble in his pocket for a penny.
The pieman was dressed like a French baker's apprentice in a white blouse and blue and white checked pants.
He appeared to be about 28 years of age.
Simon was about the same age.
But he was wearing a Buster Brown outfit.
With a wide-brimmed hat.
Dark blue blazer and short pants.
And a large red bow tie.
At the opposite end of the bar sat two women, their backs to the audience, apparently engaged in conversation. The first, Polly Flinders, was wearing a strapless dress of ash-colored chiffon with a narrow silver belt.
She sat closest to Jack Horner in boy blue, but paid no attention to them and turned frequently toward her companion, at the same time puffing on a cigarette and a shiny black cigarette holder and sipping a martini straight up with an olive.
Daffy Down Dilly, the other young woman, had long straight blonde hair which had obviously been brushed excessively so that it gleamed when it caught the light. It was several shades of blonde in easily distinguishable streaks. She wore a long emerald green velvet gown cut very low in the back and held up to glittering rhinestone straps. Her yellow lace edge petticoat hung down about an inch and a half below the hem of her gown.
She did not smoke, but from time to time sipped through a straw on a whiskey sour, also straight up. Although she frequently faced in the direction of the other characters, when she turned toward Polly,
she too paid them no mind.
After a few moments, Jack seemed to grow wary of Boy Blue's attentions and gave him a brisk shove, which sent him sprawling on the floor,
where he walked about on all fours, barking like a dog for several minutes,
causing the hyena in the bottom left tableau to stop its own prowling and fall silent, except for an occasional whimper,
as though wondering where the barking was coming from.
Soon, Boy Blue curled up in front of the bar and pretended to fall asleep, resting his head on the brass rail, and the hyena continued as before.
Jack rearranged his clothing and turned toward the barman,
who had handed him another drink.
At this point, the statue of Mercury stepped from its pedestal and seemed to float upward into the bar scene, landing on tiptoe between Jack and Simple Simon.
After a deep bow in the direction of the ladies,
who ignored him,
he turned to face the audience and delivered the following short speech.
My fellow prisoners, we have no idea how long each of us has been in this town and how long each of us intends to stay, although I have reason to believe that the lady in green over there is a fairly recent arrival. My point, however, is this. Instead of loitering this way, we should all become part of a collective movement, get involved with each other and with our contemporaries on as many levels as possible. No one will disagree that there is much to be gained from contact with one another, and I, as a god, feel it even more keenly than you do. My understanding, though universal, lacks the personal touch and the local color that would make it meaningful to me.
These words seemed to produce an uneasiness among the other patrons of the bar.
Even little Boy Blue stopped pretending to be asleep and glanced rarely at the newcomer.
The two girls had left off their conversation.
After a few moments, Daffy got down off her bar stool and walked over to Mercury.
Opening a green brocade pocketbook, she pulled out a small revolver and shot him in the chest.
The bullet passed through him without harming him and embedded itself in the fish in the mural behind the bar,
causing it to lurch forward, regurgitating blood, and drop the envelope,
which produced a loud report in a flash like a magnesium flare that illuminated an expression of anger and fear on Alice's face,
as she hastily clapped her hands over her ears.
Then the whole stage was plunged in darkness, the last thing remaining visible being the apparently permanent smile on Mercury's face, still astonished and delighted, and bearing no trace of malice.
Little by little, the darkness began to dissipate, and a forest scene similar to that in the mural was revealed. It had moved forward to fill the space formerly occupied by the bar and its customers, and was much neater and tidier than the forest in the mural had been.
The trees were more or less the same size and shape, and planted equidistant from each other. There was no forest undergrowth, no dead leaves or rotting tree trunks on the ground. The grass under the trees was as green and well-kept as that of a lawn.
This was because the scene represented a dream of Mania,
whose grotto was still visible in the lower left-hand corner of the stage,
and Since she was the goddess of confusion, her dream revealed no trace of confusion, or at any rate presented a confusing absence of confusion.
On a white banner threaded through some of the branches of the trees, in the foreground, the sentence,
"It's an ongoing thing,"
was printed in scarlet letters.
To the left, toward the rear of the scene, Alice appeared to be asleep at the base of a tree trunk, with a pig dressed in baby clothes asleep in her lap.
An invisible orchestra in the pit intoned the march from Grieg's Sigurd Jorfossar.
A group of vagabonds who had been previously hidden behind the trees moved to the center of the stage and began to perform a slow-moving ballet to the music. Each was dressed identically in baggy black and white checkered trousers, held up by white suspenders, fastened with red buttons, a crumpled back swallowtail coat, red flannel undershirt, brown derby hat, and white gloves with black stripes outlining the contours of the wrist bones. And each held in his right hand an extinguished cigar butt with a fat gray puffy ash affixed to it.
Moving delicately on point, the group formed an ever-narrowing semicircle around Alice and the sleeping pig.
When a sudden snort from the ladder startled them, and each disappeared behind a tree.
At this moment, Mania emerged from her grotto, dressed in a gown of sapphire blue tulle, studded with blue sequins, cradling a sheaf of white gladioli in the crook of one arm, and with her other hand holding aloft a wand, with a gilt cardboard star at its tip.
Only her curiously unkempt hair marred the somewhat dated elegance of her toilette. Deftly detaching the hyena's chain from its post, she allowed the beast to lead her upward to the forest scene, where the vagabonds had each begun to peek out from behind his tree trunk.
Like the Willies and Giselle, they appeared mesmerized by the apparition of the goddess, swaying to the movement of her star-tipped wand as she waved it, describing wide arcs around herself. None dared draw too close, however, for if they did so, the snarling, slavering hyena would lurch forward, straining at its chain.
At length, she let her wand droop toward the ground, and after gazing pensively downward for some moments, she raised her head and, tossing back her matted curls, spoke thus.
"My sister Hecate, who sometimes accompanies me on midnight rides to nameless and indescribable places, warned me of this dell, seemingly laid out for Sunday strolls of civil servants, but in reality the haunt of drifters and strange children. You,"
she cried, shaking her wand at the corps de ballet of vagabonds who stumbled and fell over each other in their frantic attempt to get away from her.
"You who oppress even my dreams, where a perverse order should reign, but where I find instead traces of the lunacy that besets my waking hours, are all accomplices in all this, comical and ineffectual, though you pretend to be. As for that creature,"
here she gestured toward the sleeping Alice,
"she knows only too well the implications of her presence here with that changeling and how these constitute a reflection of my inward character as illustrated in my outward appearance, such as this spangled gown and these tangled tresses meant to epitomize the confusion which is the one source of my living being, but which in these ambiguous surroundings, neither true fantasy nor clean-cut reality keeps me at bay until I can no longer see the woman I once was. I shall not rest until I have erased all of this from my thoughts, or which is more likely, incorporated into the confusing scheme I have erected around me for my support and glorification."
At this, there was some whispering and apprehensive regrouping among the vagabonds.
Meanwhile, Alice and the pig slept on oblivious, the latter's snores having become more relaxed and peaceful than before.
Mania continued to stride back and forth, impetuously stabbing her wand into the ground.
Suddenly, a black horse with a rider swathed in a dark cloak and with a dark sombrero pulled down over his face approached quickly along a path, leading through the trees from the right of the stage.
With Without dismounting or revealing his face, the stranger accosted the lady. Stranger.
Why do you pace back and forth like this, ignoring the critical reality of this scene, or pretending that it is a monstrosity of reason said by some envious, commonsensical deity to confound and humiliate you? You might have been considered beautiful and an ornament even to such a curious setting as this. Had you not persisted in spoiling the clear and surprising outline of your character and leading around this hideous, misshapen beast as though to scare off any who might have approached you so as to admire you. Mania?
I am as I am, and in that I am happy and care nothing for the opinion of others. The very idea of the idea others might entertain of me is as a poison to me, pushing me to flee farther into wastes even less hospitable and more treacherously combined of irregular elements than this one. As for my pet hyena, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. At least, I find him beautiful. And, unlike other beasts, he has the ability to laugh and sneer at the spectacle around us. Stranger,
come with me.
Come with me.
And I will take you into the presence of one.
Into the presence of one at whose court beauty and irrationality reign alternately.
And never tread on each other's toes as do your unsightly followers.
More whispering and gesturing among the vagabonds.
Where your pronounced contours may flourish and be judged for what they are worth, while the anomalies of the room you happen to be in, or the disturbing letters
and phone calls that hamper your free unorthodox development
will melt away like crystal rivulets,
leaving a glacier, and you may dwell in the accident of your character forever.
Mania?
You speak well. And if all there is as you say, I am convinced and will accompany you gladly. But before doing so, I must ask you two questions. First, what is the name of her to whose palace you purpose to lead me? And second, may I bring my hyena along? Stranger?
As to the first question, I may not answer now, but you'll find out soon enough. As to the second,
the answer is yes,
providing it behaves itself.
The lady mounted the stranger's steed with his help and sat sideways, with the hyena on its chain trotting along behind them.
As they rode back into the woods, the forest faded away, and the scene became an immense metallic sky in which a huge lead-colored sphere disk,
impossible to determine which,
seemed to float midway between the proscenium and the floor of the stage.
At right and left behind the footlights, some of the vagabonds, reduced almost to midget size, rushed back and forth, gesticulating at the strange orb that hung above them.
With them mingled a few nursery rhyme characters, such as the Knave of Hearts and the Pie Man,
who seemed to be looking around uneasily for Simon.
All were puzzled or terrified by the strange new apparition, which seemed to grow darker and denser while the sky surrounding it stayed the same white metal color.
Alice, awakening from her slumber, stood up and joined the group at the front of the stage,
leaving the pig in its baby clothes to scamper off into the wings.
Wiping away some strands of hair that had fallen across her forehead, and seeming to become aware of the changed landscape around her, she turned to the others and asked,
"What happens now?"
In reply, Jack Horner,
who had been gazing at the camera in his hand with an expression of ironic detachment,
like Hamlet contemplating the skull of Yorick,
jerked his head upward toward the banner,
whose scarlet motto still blazed brightly, though the trees that supported it were fast fading in the glare from the sky.
Alice, too, looked up, noticing it for the first time.
"I see,"
she said at length.
A process of duration has been set in motion around us, though there is no indication I can see that any one of us is involved in it. If that is the case, what conclusion are we to draw? Why are we here, if even such a nebulous concept as here is to be allowed us? What are we to do?
At this, the Knave of Hearts stepped forward and cast his eyes modestly toward the ground.
I see separate, soft pain, lady.
He said.
The likes of these.
He indicated with a sweep of his arm the group of vagabonds and others who had subsided into worried reclining poses in the background.
Who know not what they are or what they mean. I isolate from the serious business of the creatures such as we, both more ordinary and more distinguished than the common herd of anesthetized earthlings. It is so that we may question more acutely the sphere into which we have been thrust, that threatens to smother us at every second, and above which we rise, triumphant with each breath we draw. At least, that is the way I see it.
Then you are a fool as well as a knave.
Jack answered angrily.
Since you don't seem to realize that the sphere is escaping us rather than the reverse, and that in a moment it will have become one less thing to carry.
As he spoke, the stage grew very dark, so that the circle in the sky finally seemed light by contrast, while a soft wail arose from the instruments in the orchestra pit.
I suspect the mischief of Mercury in all this,
muttered Jack, keeping a weather eye on the heavens.
For though some believe Hermes' lineage to be celestial, others maintain that he is of infernal origin and emerges on Earth to do the errands of Pluto and Proserpine on the rare occasions when they have business here.
The lights slowly came up again, revealing a perspective view of a busy main street of a large American city.
The dark outline of the disk still persisted in the sky, yet the climate seemed warm and sunny, though there were Christmas decorations strung across the street and along the facades of department stores.
And on a nearby street corner stood the Salvation Army Santa Claus with his bell and cauldron.
It could have been downtown Los Angeles, in the late 30s or early to mid 40s, judging from the women's fashions and the models of cars that crawled along the street as though pulled by invisible strings.
Walking in place on a sidewalk, which was actually a treadmill moving toward the back of the stage, was a couple in their early 30s.
Mania.
For the woman was none other than she.
Was dressed in the style of Joan Crawford and Mildred Pierce.
In a severe suit with padded shoulders and a pillbox with a veil crowning the pin curls of her upswept hairdo.
Which also cascaded to her shoulders.
Ending in more pin curls.
Instead of the sheaf of gladioli, she now clutched a black handbag suspended on a strap over her shoulder. And in place of the hyena, one of those little white dogs on the end of a leash kept sniffing the legs of pedestrians who were, in truth, mere celluloid phantoms, part of the process shot which made up the whole downtown backdrop.
The man at her side wore a broad-brimmed hat, loose-fitting spur coat, and baggy, garbage-in slacks.
He bore a certain resemblance to the actor Bruce Bennett, but closer inspection revealed him to be the statue of Mercury, with the paint still peeling from his face around the empty eye sockets.
At first, it looked as though the two were enjoying the holiday atmosphere and drinking in the sights and sounds of the city.
Gradually.
However.
Mania's expression darkened.
Finally, she stopped in the middle of the sidewalk and pulled at her escort's sleeve.
Listen, Herman.
She said, perhaps addressing Bruce Bennett by his real name, Herman Bricks.
You said you were going to take me to this swell place and all, where I was supposed to meet a lot of interesting people who could help me in my career. All we do is walk down this dopey street looking in store windows and waiting for the stoplights to change. Is this your idea of a good time?
But this is all part of it, hun. Part of what I promised you.
Mercury rejoined.
Don't you feel the atmosphere yet? that powder blue of the eternal postcard, with the haze of mountain peaks barely visible, the salmon-colored pavement with its little green and blue cars that look so still, though they are supposed to be in motion, the window shoppers, people like you and me.
That's what I thought.
Mania pouted, stamping one of her feet in its platform shoe so loudly that several of the extras turned to look.
Atmosphere. That's what it was all along, wasn't it? A question of ambience, poetry, something like that. I might as well have stayed in my cave for all the good it's going to do me. After all, I'm used to not blending in with the environment. It's my business not to. But I thought you were going to take me away from all that, to some place where scenery made no difference anymore, where I could be what everybody accuses me of being, and what I suppose I must be, my tired, tyrannical self, as separate from local color as geometry is from the hideous verticals of these avenues and buildings and the festoons that extend them into the shrinking consciousness. Have you forgotten the words of St. Augustine? Multiply in your imagination the light of the sun. Make it greater and brighter as you will, 1,000 times or out of number. God will not be there?
Then we all realize what should have been obvious from the start.
That the setting would go on evolving, eternally, rolling its waves across our vision like an ocean.
Each one new yet recognizably a part of the same series, which was creation itself.
Scenes from movies, plays, operas, television.
Decisive, or little-known episodes from history.
Prenatal and other early memories from our own solitary, separate past.
Events yet to come from life or art.
Calamities, or moments of relaxation.
Universal or personal tragedies.
Or little vignettes from daily life that you had just had to stop and laugh at.
They were so funny.
Sorry. Like the dog chasing its tail on the living room rug.
The sunny city in California faded away, and another scene took its place. And another. And another.
And the corollary of all this was that we would go on witnessing these tableaux.
Not that anything prevented us from leaving the theater.
But there was no alternative to our interest in finding out what would happen next.
This was the only thing that mattered for us, so we stayed on, although we could have stood up and walked away in disgust at any given moment.
An event followed event, according to an inner logic of its own.
We saw the set for the first act of La Boheme, picturesque poverty on a large scale, enough to fill the stages of the world's greatest opera houses, from Leningrad to Buenos Aires, punctuated only by a skylight, an easel or two, and a stove with a smoking stovepipe, but entirely filled up with the boisterous and sincere camaraderie of Rodolfo, Marcello, Colleen, and their friends.
A ripe, generous atmosphere in which Mimi is introduced like the first splinter of unavoidable death, and the scene melts imperceptibly into the terrace of Café Mamouche, where the friends have gathered to drink and discuss philosophy.
When suddenly, the blonde actress, who had earlier been seen as Daffy Down Dilly, returns as Musetta, mocking her elderly protector and pouring out peal after peal of deathless melody concerning the joys and advantages of life as a grisette.
Meanwhile, clutching a small velvet handbag in which the contour of a small revolver was clearly visible, for as we well knew from previous experience, she was the symbol of the unexpectedness and exuberance of death.
Which we'd waited to come around again, and which we would be meeting many times more during the course of the performance.
There were murky scenes from television, with a preponderance of excerpts from Jacques Cousteau documentaries with snorkeling figures disappearing down aqueous perspectives.
Past arrangements of coral still lifes and white, fan-like creatures made of snowy tripe whose trailing, vine-like tentacles could paralyze a man for life.
And a seeming excess of silver bubbles constantly being emitted from here and there to sweep upward to to the top of the screen where they vanished.
There were old clips from Lucy, Lassie, and the Waltons.
There was Walter Cronkite bidding us urgent good evening years ago.
Lucy, there were just moments.
A street corner viewed from above.
Bare branches lit in the sky.
A child in a doorway.
A painted Pennsylvania Dutch chest.
A full moon disappearing behind a dark cloud to the accompaniment of a Japanese flute.
A ballerina in a frosted white dress lifted up into the light.
Always behind it, the circle in the sky remained fixed like a ghost on the television screen. The setting was now the last act of Isbin's When We Dead Awaken.
A wild, broken mountaintop with a sheer precipice behind. To the right tower, snowy peaks, losing themselves high up in drifting mist. To the left on a scree stands an old tumble-down hut. It is early morning. Dawn is breaking. The sun has not yet risen.
Here is the disk in the sky could begin to make of the properties of the sun that had been denied it for so long. As though we made of wet wool, it began little by little to soak up and distribute light.
The figure of Mercury had become both more theatrical and more human.
No longer a statue, he was draped in a freshly laundered chlamys that set off his well-formed but slight physique.
The broad-brimmed pedicis sat charmingly on his curls.
He sat, legs spread apart, on an iron park bench, digging absent-mindedly at the ground with his staff, from which leaves rather than serpents sprouted, occasionally bending over to scratch the part of his heel behind the strap of his winged sandal.
The morning's mists were evaporating.
The light was becoming the ordinary yellow daylight of the theater.
Resting both hands on his staff, he leaned forward to address the audience, cocking his head in the shrewd bumpkin manner of a Will Rogers.
So, you think I have it, after all? Or that I've found it? And you may be right. But I still say that what counts isn't the particular set of circumstances, but how we adapt ourselves to them. And you almost know that by now, watching all these changes of scene and scenery till you feel it's coming out of your ears. I know how it is. I've been everywhere, bearing messages to this one and that one, often steaming them open to see what's inside and getting a good dose of that too. In addition to the peaks of Tartarus, which I might be flying over at the time. It's like sleeping too close to the edge of the bed. Sometimes you're in danger of falling out on one side and sometimes on the other. But rarely do you fall out. And in general, your dreams proceed pretty much in the normal way dreams have of proceeding. I still think the old plain way is better. The ideas, speeches, arguments, whatever you want to call them. And on one hand, and strongly written scenes and fully fleshed out characters in flannel suits and Lego mutton sleeves on the other. For the new moon is most beautiful viewed through burnt twigs and the last few decrepit leaves still clinging to them.
Suddenly, he glanced upward toward the screen and noticed a girl in a Victorian shirtwaist and a straw boater hat moving timidly down the path through the now wildly swirling mists. She was giggling silently with embarrassment and wonder, meanwhile clasping an old-fashioned Kodak, which she had pointed at Mercury.
It is Sabrina, he said. The wheel has lost come full circle, and it is the simplicity of an encounter that was meant all along. It happened ever so many years ago when we were children, and could have happened so many times since, but it isn't our fault that it has chosen this moment, and this moment only, to repeat itself. For even if it does menace us directly, it's exciting all the same.
And the avalanche fell. And fell.
And continues to fall.
Even today.